Thank you. sung by Mrs. Mona Slater and the band. Gentlemen, Republicans all. As chairman of the Republican Party of Milwaukee County, it is a pleasure and an honor to welcome to Milwaukee Mr. Harold E. Stassen, former governor of Minnesota. We are also happy to welcome to Milwaukee a large delegation of Republicans from Minnesota. Including a goodly number of our fellow workers from South St. Paul. They have traveled to Milwaukee by train, automobile, plane, and we would judge some of them by horseback, to be present at this historic meeting. Those of you who saw the parade this evening know that we have with us, too, many delegations from other Wisconsin cities and villages. To you, Badgers, also a most cordial welcome. We are gathered tonight, folks, on a momentous occasion, and we should not for 1 minute forget that point. Presidential campaigns are a vital part of American history and a vital part of our Republican form of government. The destiny of this nation and the destiny of the world have been altered by such campaigns. Having in mind the grave importance, the national and international magnitude of the forthcoming presidential campaign, we local Republicans feel that Milwaukee County is highly honored to be chosen as the starting point of the campaign of one of the major candidates for the Republican nomination for president, Mr. Harold Stassen. And with our hopes high for a Republican victory in 1948, there is added importance to this campaign. We realize full well that the eyes of America are on Milwaukee tonight. The Republican Party of Milwaukee County fully appreciates this honor. We appreciate the recognition of the importance of this city as a factor in national Republican politics. And it is gratifying to see so many Republicans taking such an active interest in the candidates for the presidential nomination. Sustained interest of this sort will ensure a Republican victory, a Republican president in 1948. I'll bring out the watch because, as most of you know, Mr. Sasson's speech this evening is being broadcast over some 260 stations of the American Broadcasting Company. That will necessitate a strict schedule, and we will stay to adhere to that schedule very strictly. First, though, we will hear from a man who is making his first appearance before the most of you in his new capacity as state chairman of the Republican Party of Wisconsin. It's Harvey Higley of Marinette. Mr. Higley?
Thank you, Mr. Murray, distinguished guests and fellow Republicans. For the Republican Party of Wisconsin, may I add a word of welcome and greeting to our distinguished guests, to you folks from Minnesota, and to all of you who are showing your interest here in this meeting. And may I urge all of you to give all the help and support you can to our work during the coming months if we are to have a real Republican victory next year in the state and in the nation. Now, most of you know that in Wisconsin, the people directly elect delegates to the convention. Furthermore, our election, at which time the people can show their preferences for presidential candidates, that election comes early in the year, and therefore Wisconsin has become somewhat of a traditional testing ground for presidential candidates. Now, at once, that places a very distinct responsibility on all of us. And if we are to discharge that responsibility as we should, it would be well if we could meet face to face all of the candidates who aspire to this very high office, so that we will know them, so that we can hear their solutions, perhaps, of some of the great problems that beset our nation, and so that we can learn of the ideals that will motivate their actions and their thinking. Tonight, we are to have that pleasure of hearing from a man who deserves our most careful consideration, and in his customary forthright manner, he is going to answer many of the questions that are in your mind. I can assure Governor Sasson that if he is accorded the nomination at Philadelphia next year, it will be a great pleasure for me personally and for the Republican Party of Wisconsin to give him the best possible support, and I thoroughly believe a very substantial majority. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Higley. We will hear next from another man well known in Republican circles, in Wisconsin and in the nation, Mr. Cyrus L. Phillip, the Republican National Committeeman from Wisconsin. Mr. Phillip.
Mr. Murray, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, for 15 years, the federal administration has been in the hands of another party. And as a result, the nation faces one of the greatest national and international crises in its history. During the past 2 years, the people have indicated by their vote in state and congressional elections that they are tired of administrative bungling and uncertainty. In electing a Republican majority to the National Congress, they have clearly indicated their desire for a return to Republican administration. The nation will elect a Republican president next year. The Republicans of Wisconsin and other states, by indicating their desire in conventions and primary elections, may well determine what man will sit in the White House in 1948. We have with us this evening the first avowed candidate for the Republican nomination, Mr. Harold E. Stassi, distinguished former governor of Minnesota, announced several months ago his intention to seek the Republican nomination. Tonight, here in Milwaukee, he opens his national campaign for that nomination. I am happy that the people of Wisconsin are to have this opportunity to hear Mr. Stassi. I hope that they will have an equal opportunity to hear all of the Republican candidates for the Republican nomination. If they have that opportunity and exercise their right to vote, the Republican who is elected to the presidency next year will truly be the man of their choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Phillips. We have with us this evening a most distinguished leader in Mr. Stassi's home state, a man who came to Milwaukee from St. Paul to speak to you tonight about this candidate. It is now a pleasure and a privilege to present to you the governor of our fine neighboring state, and I might say a state that maybe produces football teams that are just a little too good at times. Nevertheless, it is a real pleasure and an honor to introduce the Honorable Luther W. Youngdahl, Governor of Minnesota. Governor Youngdahl.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Seated, please. Thank you. Mr. Murray, Mr. Stassi, Senator McCarthy, other guests, and fellow citizens. We in Minnesota have had a taste of the dynamic and courageous leadership of Harold E. Stassi, and we like it. Because we know that the nation today is desperately in need of that same quality of leadership, we propose to share it with the people of this country. We know what that type of leadership has brought in the way of good government to the state of Minnesota. We know, too, that that same type of leadership can restore good government to the national capital at Washington. There are thousands upon thousands of Republicans all over this country that are getting awfully tired of merely nominating candidates. This time, these Republicans insist that they're not only going to nominate a candidate, they're going to elect a candidate as president. And they know, too, that whether or not they are going to elect a candidate as president on the Republican ticket depends upon the kind of candidate they nominate, that they've got to nominate a winner in order to elect him. That's why tonight, all over the nation, the eyes of our people are on Harold E. Stassi. His fearless, his frank and his able discussion of the major issues of the day have brought the people to realize that he will be a winner if nominated. We of Minnesota know the reason why Harold Stassen will be a winner. We have seen the recent polls, which indicate that of all the Republican candidates, he leads them all in the respect and the confidence that he has among the independent voters of the nation. And a Republican candidate has got to get his substantial share of the independent vote in order to win in the general election. We people in Minnesota understand why Harold E. Stassen commands the respect of the independent vote. We saw him, as you neighbors of ours in Wisconsin saw him operate in that important year in 1938. You knew the type of government we had in Minnesota during those hectic years preceding that election. Riots and strikes and bloodshed and bad government. Then came Harold E. Stassen. He sold himself to the farmer, to the laborer, to the businessman, to people with all nationality backgrounds and all types of vocational activity. And he kept faith with those people after he took his oath of office. Because by means of reorganization and streamlining of the state government, by means of installing business practices in the state government, after he had eliminated the spoiled system for good, he started to reduce state taxes and cut state expenditures and brought good government to the state of Minnesota. And it has stayed there since 1938 under successive Republican administrations. But I think the character of the man is especially significant in his activity in management labor relations. Harold E. Stassen, with his inspired leadership, brought into being the Minnesota Labor Relations Law, which has become a model for other states of the Union. And by reason of his fair administration of that law, Minnesota has had a complete transformation in management labor relations. Whereas prior to 38, we had one of the worst records in the country. Since 1938, Minnesota has had one of the best records in the country in management labor relations. Harold E. Stassen has an enduring concern for all of the people, and he has brought that concern into play in his dealings with management and with labor. He understands that the employer and the employee have the same fears and the same aspirations, the same strength and the same weaknesses. And he has an uncanny ability to detect the weaknesses in both groups and to recognize the strength in both groups and to bring them together in a spirit of understanding and amity and cooperation. We need that type of cooperation and confidence between management and labor at the national capital at Washington. And then you are familiar with his substantial contribution in bringing into being the United Nations Charter. He won the respect of the spokesmen of the various nations of the world because of his depth of understanding, because of his resourcefulness, because of his clarity of thought, his spirit of neighborliness that is so characteristic of this great Midwest section of the country. He convinced those representative leaders of the other nations of the world that he was a great late leader. That is why, fellow citizens, neighbors of Wisconsin, we are so happy tonight to join with you in presenting to the nation our favorite son of Minnesota. That is why we are so glad tonight to dedicate with you our efforts in participating in a great crusade to bring good government to the national capital at Washington. This is a fateful day in the history of our country, because we believe that this is the beginning of the bringing of a man of destiny to Washington, D.C., who will lead the people of this country and the people of the world to a new day of understanding, of happiness, of prosperity, and of peace.
Too much rest. Some of us the other day got a look at the schedule. This candidate for the Republican nomination for president. One look at that schedule reminded me of a farmhand that hired out up near Ogdensburg. He worked there about 10 days. He was going to quit. The farmer said, "What are you quitting for?" Said, "Well, when I started work here, you promised me steady work. There's 3-4 hours every night that I don't have anything to do but sleep." Believe me, folks, the schedule of this candidate for presidential nomination would make that farmhand look like a piker, make him look like a drone. Nevertheless, they're standing up under it admirably, and we have another gentleman here with us tonight, well-known in Wisconsin. Apparently, about 11 months ago or 9 months ago, he was very well known and has grown in the hearts of Wisconsin's people since. When he came into a primary election and won the primary and general election, and he is now going to introduce Mr. Stassen on the air. That has about 3 minutes and a half or 4 minutes to go. As some of you folks who may know who are connected with radio, that is one thing that is rather definitely timed. They don't mean, when they say 30, they don't mean 30 and 40 seconds, they mean 30. Nevertheless, our own junior senator from Wisconsin, and our mighty state, we're proud to say a native of Wisconsin all the way through, our own Honorable Joseph McCarthy, United States Senator, will introduce Mr. Stassen on the air.
Accurate is this watch, incidentally. It's about a minute off of my... But first, I would like to very sincerely thank my very good friend, Harold Stassen, for formerly opening his campaign here in my own state of Wisconsin, in the city of Milwaukee. And I would appreciate it very much if we could give him a good hand for doing that. Secondly, and what is more important, I would like to have you become acquainted with the only really good thing, but I should say one of the really good things I know about Governor Stassen, I may get shot for this, but Mrs. Stassen, I wonder if you would stand up. I'm not going to ask you to make a speech, Mrs. Stassen, but I wish you would say hello. Will you do that? Come on, come on. This was unscheduled.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here this evening.
Hey, where do I get the signal as when we're going on the air so I can start the formal introduction? Would you do that? While we're waiting to do that, I would like to point out to you one of the reasons why I personally am wholeheartedly 100% for Harold Stassen for president, and why I think that all good Republicans, regardless of how much you may think of some of the other candidates, should be for him. Presently, we have a very, very thin margin in the Senate. We've got unusual circumstances coming year. Practically all of the Democratic senators who will be running for re-election are in good, solid Democratic states. Unfortunately, that is not true of our Republicans running for the Senate. And it is going to take not only a man who will make a good president, but also a man who will be a good candidate, or for the next 4 years we will have the very, very unfortunate circumstance of having the administration of one political faith and the Senate of another. And you know how thoroughly that can... 1 minute? 10 seconds? This certainly makes it easy to talk to you. I'm just going to wait until those 10 seconds are up. United States and the Republican Party are fortunate indeed to find so many outstanding men seeking the Republican nomination for president. Tonight it is my good fortune to present to you a man who stands out in that field of outstanding men. Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you the next President of the United States, Harold E. Stassen. Your Excellency Governor Youngdahl, Chairman Murray, distinguished guests, my neighbors of Wisconsin, fellow citizens all. 2 years ago,
Upon return to civilian life and being questioned in Chicago as to my future activities, I responded that I intended to do everything within my power to help build a truly liberal, humanitarian, and victorious Republican Party. And a year ago, on December 17th in Washington, on being directly asked by the press whether I intended to be a candidate for the Republican nomination for president, I answered frankly and truthfully, yes, I do. Tonight, in Milwaukee, before this great audience, we open the definite drive for delegates to the Republican National Convention in Philadelphia and for nomination as the Republican standard bearer in 1948. Tonight, insofar as possible, within the limits of one short address, I wish to pledge to you what my objectives would be as your president, what the method of conducting our campaign will be, and what you can do if you wish to help. Now, I realize full well that this is not considered as the politically wise thing to do. I know that the powerful president pickers consider that it is wrong to be so frank and forthright with the members of the Republican Party and with the people of America. It is their view that the correct procedure is to conduct a very elaborate operation of looking the other way, that the hard, controversial issues of the day should be avoided, and the people should not be told our views upon them, that a long vacation trip should be taken, admiring mountains and lakes and rivers and flowers and crops and livestock, but that great care should be taken never to meet a difficult, real problem face to face. Now, these riders of regal reaction hold that a position of photogenic availability should be maintained until such time as a key group of their men with delegates in their pockets make hard, tough, secret deals for a nomination and a subsequent administration. Needless to add, whatever may be my own political fortune, I do not believe in that type of politics in America. I do not believe that that will yield the kind of administration and leadership that is essential for our country in this critical period in world history. Thus, at the very opening of our campaign, I present to you, straight from the shoulder, the overall goals that I would have as your president. These are the two goals which we would keep before us as the beacon light while we thought and acted upon the manifold day-to-day and month-to-month problems. First, to gain an increasingly better life for ourselves and for others, avoiding booms and busts, and vigorously maintaining a free economy in America. Second, to win an expanding individual freedom for Americans and for mankind without the tragedy of a Third World War. All other issues would be kept in a position subordinate to these overall objectives, and all other problems would be resolved, having in mind their effect on these overriding goals. Specific discussion of some of our more immediate and detailed questions might serve to throw light upon my meaning in the broad stroke of these statements, and will also stimulate consideration of the specific detailed measures. As you know, I've presented in greater detail and precision in my book, Where I Stand, proposals on a wide range of these issues. It is my view that if we are to maintain a healthy domestic economy in America, we must give priority in our attention to the two dark spots in our economic system, the extreme shortage of housing and the lack of adequate health service for the average citizen. We need a solid, united support of the people of America behind our economic system and our form of government if we are to be successful in the crucial world contest of ways of life in which we are now engaged. But is it not clear that brilliant oratory about the American system falls on slightly skeptical ears when it reaches those million and more of our veterans who served their country in the late war, but now cannot find a home for themselves and their families? We must take major, resolute action to break through the housing jam in America. It requires action by government. It should be action consistent with the fundamental principles of individual ownership, private capital, and free workmen of the American system. Specifically, here is what I propose: that the federal government promptly embark upon a major mass house building program in which huge projects of as many as 25,000 units of houses or apartments are let out on contract to private builders for mass on-the-spot construction. Through this, we'll begin to translate to the house-building field the kind of efficiency, economy, and speed which America has developed in the building of automobiles and refrigerators and tractors, radio and furniture and airplanes. Cities selected for the project should be those that are not only congested, but in which the city administration presents a modern, up-to-date building ordinance which does not hamstring with archaic provisions the attempts at modern construction. They should be the cities in which building labor modernizes its rules and practices, and instead of presenting a network of feather-bedding rules with petty jurisdictional squabbles between them, developed at a time when they were seeking to protect shrinking building jobs in a depression, instead adopts a new set of rules designed to build the largest possible number of houses at the least cost and the greatest speed, and then depend upon the entire success of the whole American economy for their future high employment in the building trades and their steady jobs. These major projects should be developed in a manner that the supply of lumber and plumbing and electrical equipment and all the other component parts of a house are expanded for the project. The entire field of ordinary construction, of tailor-made houses to suit owners, or of private builders for resale, should be encouraged to proceed in its present manner. The major new developments under the federal mass home building program should be used in the first instance to expand the number of houses available. And then, as total construction steps up and the availability of housing improves, the federal program should replace as many existing structures in the slums of our great cities as new units are furnished, so that in their long-range calculations, private capital and builders can make their plans and their estimates and do their building without major regard for the federal program. Experiences of the last 20 years with a very difficult restraint by ordinances and local taxes and union practices seem to me to clearly call for this kind of a major action to break through and bring to the housing field something of the genius of America in mass production. But equally important, Uncle Sam should not become a landlord. We need Uncle Sam to break through the housing deadlock, the retarding effects of all these factors in building. But I propose that the finished houses in this program should be promptly sold, partly to owner-occupiers and owner-cooperative occupiers, somewhat as is in the Swedish and Norwegian plans, and partly to insurance companies and other sources of major capital for investment and rental. I'm opposed to public housing in which government becomes the landlord, as it has all the abuses and the weakness of bureaucratic supervision, and it opens up political favoritism, and it adds excess centralized power in government. In the health field, it is my proposal that new insurance coverage be extended for major medical and hospital expense, but not for the ordinary run of such expense. Specifically, everyone on Social Security should be covered by a new insurance that will pay duly verified and reasonable bills, which are necessarily incurred for medical and hospital expense in excess of $250 in any one year. Amounts below $250 in a year are to continue to be the personal responsibility of the individual to be covered by savings or payments by himself or by his own voluntary Blue Cross hospital plan or personal private insurance or other means. Through this means, the economic catastrophe that now comes with major illness or accident to an individual or one of his loved ones is removed, but the entire independence of the medical profession and the personal responsibility of the individual citizen for his ordinary expense is retained. This proposal is presented as a means of working out on an admittedly important medical and health problem, and doing it without entering into the evils of the overall compulsory medical insurance program, such as the Wagner-Murray-Dingle bill. I consider I consider this to be an American type of answer to a difficult social and economic problem which must be met for the future welfare of the people of America. It is my further view that a whole set of policies must be inaugurated to prevent the boom and bust tendencies of our free economy. Among these are reduction in taxes to specifically give a break to small new businesses and to avoid taking more than one half of the income of any citizen in our country in time of peace. Both of these measures are important to stimulate the dynamics of our capitalism, to broaden the competition and increase the production of our total economic machine. They'll tend to prevent the boom side of our cycle and to build bulwarks against the depth of our depression drop. With this revision in taxes should come a constant emphasis on efficiency in the federal government, with a streamlining of the administrative setups and the spending of less money in the civilian activities in Washington. This is not only important for the purpose of fairness to agriculture, but it is also a great safeguard against depression in our economic system. This means specifically that floors need to be maintained to safeguard the income of the family-sized farm and to stimulate production. Coupled with this, there must be a soil conservation program and continuous research in new uses for agricultural products, new varieties of seeds, and reclamation and water conservation. A labor policy that is fair and just and maintains a balance between individually managed capital and free, organized labor is imperative. In my judgment, this will develop out of the Taft-Hartley law with comparatively minor amendments of that law in accordance with our experience under it. I do not agree with the attacks upon the law made by labor's leadership, and I submit that if the members of organized labor examine this law, which has been labeled as a bad package, they'll find that it has good contents for them and for their country. The provisions to prevent quickie strikes, for example, in public utilities and coal and steel and shipping and transportation are good provisions. The provisions for greater accountability of labor's leadership to their own members of finances and other union affairs are good provisions. The provisions to decrease the jurisdictional strikes and outlawing the secondary boycott are good provisions. Building upon the concept that the overwhelming majority of the working men and women of America are as loyal and faithful to their country as are any other citizens, we can develop a fair labor policy that maintains a balance between capital and labor and yields productive results for all in America. Our American economic system has yielded a higher production, a fairer distribution of goods to all than any other economic system in the history of the world. by alert developments to meet new problems, by holding fast to fundamentals, but being willing to reach out in new applications, there is no reason why this country cannot maintain extremely high production without economic crashes or depressions, with an increasing fairness of distribution and a better life for its people. Accomplishing this will be one of the major factors contributing to the advance of standards of living of peoples in other parts of the world and avoiding the Holocaust of a Third World War. I say this because it is clear that a major change is needed in the foreign policy of the Soviet Union of Russia if we are to have bright prospects for a lasting peace. The foreign policy of Russia now is based upon the concept that our capitalism is bound to have an economic crash and to fail. One of the premises for change will be the demonstration that they are wrong in this concept. Our success at home, coupled with our affirmative aid to peoples in other parts of the world, carrying out the Marshall Plan and aid to China, which are now receiving almost unanimous support in America, will cause an increasing movement toward economic freedom for the individual, a turning away from the confining effects and low productivity and decreasing liberty of both socialism and communism, with a larger flow of trade and a steadily improving standard of living for peoples everywhere. We look forward to the day when not only the peoples of Western Europe, but also the peoples of Eastern Europe, including Poland, where fate has been so tragic and unfair, are enjoying a better standard of living and more of freedom than their present plight. For this purpose, we will rebuild a peaceful Ruhr, a peaceful Germany, with careful supervision to ensure against subversion. Clearly, however, concentration upon economic strength must not be our only approach to the world's problems of peace. We must follow a consistent overall foreign policy in America. And one of the first inconsistencies to correct is that of the present shipments of machine tools and precision instruments and steel products to Russia. Unless and until America reaches clear agreements with Russia for the constructive and open building in good faith toward peace, we should not ship one single machine or material that could become a part of a communist war machine. We also need to give continuous, affirmative, strong backing to the growth and development of the United Nations, to recognize its limitations in its early stages, and maintain for ourselves a strong military position for our own future security and for its stable effect in the world. We are clear that we will not permit aggression anywhere in the world. We must make it clear that we know that the best way to defend the freedom of the American people is to oppose ruthless aggression wherever it first arises in this modern post-war world. As your president, I would seek to make it constantly evident to all the nations of the world that they need never fear aggression from America But if they commit aggression, they will have cause to fear the counter moves of a great, strong, free America. I would seek to make it clear that we would never follow a policy of appeasement toward anyone, and we would not repeat the mistakes of Munich or of Potsdam. We must remain and maintain such strength that no one is tempted to try aggression by force or to endeavor to dominate us by force. And further, so that if war does come again to this world, we will win, and win with a minimum of loss of life. This requires maintaining manpower in our armed forces to a reasonable degree, keeping strong and trained reserves, alert and ready air power, and to be up ahead with our research. We would also definitely move to clear up communist infiltration in America and do it with complete respect for constitutional rights and individual civil liberties in our country. In this respect, we would concentrate, first of all, upon improving the situation in New York, which is now the center of communist activity in this country. Over 40% of the known communists are in New York. It is the place of publication of their newspaper, The Daily Worker. It is the headquarters for the activities of the communists. It's also the center of infiltration of some of the major labor unions. It has been a natural target for their actions because of its being such a key center of communication and of trade and of press. With the cooperation of federal, state, and local governments, this can be promptly cleared up. Now, in the succeeding weeks and months, I intend to spell out in detail our program upon the important issues of our time, relating them to our overall objectives and goals. I will not do so with an attitude that these things exactly must be done. Rather do I expose detailed suggestions to stimulate the search for answers, that others might come to the fore with additional facts and alternative proposals, and we might find together the best program that America can follow and that our Republican Party can present. The best of progress in America has been made when liberal, forward-looking proposals have been blended and adjusted with conservative attitudes into an agreed program of action. In that sense, I do not clash with the conservatives of the Republican Party, but rather do I seek the area of agreement with them, the basis on which we can join in action by the Congress and by the nation. I say to you tonight very frankly, but if you agree substantially with the proposals and the goals that we present, I would appreciate your support in this campaign. It will be a hard, uphill fight. We'll need to overcome some of the entrenched prejudice within our party. We'll need to reach the millions of the people of the country with our message. We'll need to win primaries and win conventions. The fight will be an uphill fight, but it'll be a fight worth waging for the future of America. If you join with us, speak to your friends, and your neighbors, and your relatives. To this great auditorium audience, I frankly add, remember that it also takes money to carry on a nationwide campaign. Speak to the Republican leaders, you know. Enlist the new voters. Steadily build support, looking toward a victory in the Wisconsin primary on next April 6th, in the national convention in June, and in the final election in November 1948. but above all, look forward to a forthright, vigorous administration of the government of this great country in this crucial period in history, with our eyes lifted to the twin goals of gaining a better life and winning expanding freedom for ourselves and for others in a world at peace.